Welcome to this special extra edition of Cinematica, New Zealand's favourite movie podcast. My name is Dan Slavin. Mr. Pip is a new drama written for the screen and directed by Andrew Adamson, most famous for Shrek and the Narnia films. It's based on the 2007 Man Booker shortlisted novel by Wellingtonian Lloyd Jones, and it's set in a remote area of Bougainville during the early 1990s rebellion and blockade. Hugh Laurie plays Watts, the only white man left in the village, who takes up the challenge of teaching the village children by introducing them to Charles Dickens' Great Expectations. After a preview screening of the film on Monday night, Lloyd Jones was generous enough to join me on stage at the Lighthouse Cuba to answer some of my questions and questions from the audience. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the Lighthouse stage, Lloyd Jones. Thank you. Take a seat.
Is this on?
It is on now. Yes, indeed. All right. We've got a few people have ducked out to take the opportunity while there was a lull in the conversation to go to the bathroom. So hopefully they'll be on their way back shortly. But what I thought I'd do is set the scene for you and for everybody else here. Just a reminder that we are recording this Q&A session for Cinematica, which is a New Zealand's movie podcast, and we'll be editing the highlights of that for the show that goes out this Wednesday. What it does mean is that because we don't have roving microphones rolling around the room, I'll be trying to repeat your questions back so that they can be captured for the recording. So please bear that in mind. Also, please bear in mind that there is a spotlight in the far corner, which is effectively blinding both Lloyd and I. So when you want to ask a question, and if you want something to contribute, don't just put your hand up. You might have to wave it around a bit so that we can sense the movement. So what we'll do first is I've got a couple of questions that I'd like to ask before we get too far into proceedings. They'll be sort of fairly general, sort of warm-up type questions, I expect. Hopefully that will leave plenty of ground still for you guys. So there was a round of applause at the end of the credits rolling. And you missed that, unfortunately. So perhaps you would like to do that again.
Well, thank you. But I'm not the filmmaker. I'm just the representative of the filmmaker.
Well, and we're very glad to have you here. But let's be honest, the film wouldn't exist, would it, if you hadn't had the spark of inspiration to begin with. So let's start with that. Where did Mr. Pip, the literary... Where was the genesis of that idea?
Okay. You can't believe how many times I've been asked that question.
Well, then you'll have a really...
And I don't mean to be impolite. You've probably... Many of you may have heard about the genesis of Mr. Pip before. I feel like I've said it so many times. But really, it goes right back to 1989, 1990. And it was... you would have seen the newsreel on the film there when the blockade was imposed by PNG. Well, in the Evening Post, there was just one paragraph describing this blockade, and I was completely intrigued. One, I'd never heard of Bougainville, and it didn't sound like a very Pacific a name for the Pacific. And I was just completely captured by the notion of a blockade, of an island just being kind of roped off like that. And I anticipated the worst happening, and indeed the worst did. And so I endeavoured to go there. And I actually I wrote a long article for the Sydney Morning Herald. I didn't actually get to Bougainville on that particular trip. I subsequently did. But on that particular trip, I was taking a boat from Lae across to Rabaul. And it was an overnight boat, and in the wheelhouse of that boat, there was a PNG defence officer drinking beer. And I went into the wheelhouse, and as the night went on, he got more and more drunk and proceeded to tell me how they were taking the rebels out to sea, dropping them out to sea, and dropping them over the forests of Bougainville. And so I wrote, I couldn't write this in front of him. I kept ducking into the toilet to write down notes and spent a lot of time in the toilet. And anyway, wrote my story. And in Australia, actually, it was quite a big deal because the helicopters that the PNG Defence Force were using were Australian Iroquois helicopters. So, you know, there was repercussions, political repercussions there, yeah. So, look, it was just a response, a journalistic response at the time. And then I think what happens with all writers is that you save landscapes and situations. They go into some sort of bank of memory. And when I began to write it, what I was writing about around 2005-06, Bougainville just surfaced at that particular point.
And the rationale behind introducing a Westerner, a white guy, into that environment, was that to sort of just make it easy to provide that outsider's perspective on what was going on?
A rationale. Rationality doesn't come into writing. That's in the film world where everything's got to be stitched together and in a very logistical way. No, it just happened. I had this image of a white guy towing a black woman behind in a cart, and I was intrigued by that image. Where did that come from? Who saw that? Well, suddenly the voice of the person who saw that was Matilda. That came to me almost instantaneously as I recognised where this place was, Bougainville. And so there was a whole... What I'd been working on was this notion that... and it's actually in the film there, a Pākehā guy is married to a Polynesian woman and they're decorating this room for their unborn child. And that room is supposed to be a metaphor for the new Pacific, where the child will pick and choose in terms of mythology and ancestry and belief systems. But I set myself a task that was a little bit too difficult in some respects because I forgot about narrative. And... but nonetheless, as soon as Matilda's voice came to me, I, you know, the whole thing just became invested in this place, and you got the undercurrent of the war and all that kind of thing. So it all came alive very, very, very quickly and surprisingly.
It seems kind of obvious now that it's an amazingly cinematic place, location, environment, situation. Was Andrew Adamson the first person to approach you to talk about adapting it for cinema?
No. Casarotto, the agents for film in London, were the ones handling the sale of the film, and they put the word out and got a lot of interest and a short list of three or four directors. And I remember Casarotto rang me, or Charlotte Kelly rang me in Berlin. I was living in Berlin at the time. She said, "You have to talk to these directors. They're going to ring you and they're going to be pitching." I said, "I really don't want to do that. Can't you take that phone call?" "No, no, you have to." Awful business. I sat up there late at night in Berlin, and Andrew was last. And I was completely captivated by what he had to say and also his own story. I mean, he had grown up in PNG. He had said that he'd met any number of people who reminded him of Mr. Watts. He was fluent in Pidgin. And when I said, "Look, the film has to be shot there and using local people," he didn't flinch, you know. So I thought that was a good sign.
Background as a director, you presumably were familiar with the likes of Shrek and Narnia and what have you. Neither of those series of projects lend themselves to this sort of thing.
No, they don't. But I did think of that. but I got the sense that in a way it was somebody who was squaring off his creative side with where he had grown up. There was a sort of a paying homage because his uncle, I think it was his uncle or his great uncle, was a missionary in Bougainville, and he grew up, of course. He spent about 10 years, I think, in PNG. So there was a sort of a he was an opportunity to revisit his formative years, his childhood years via this film.
There's always a major transition from one form to another when you go from literature to cinema. How close or how much did you care about what ended up on the screen, or were you content for him to take it and make it his own?
Yeah, I made no creative demands or claims whatsoever. I feel that if you've bought the rights to the film, you've bought the right to reimagine. But as it turned out, he was remarkably faithful to the book, and they very cunningly made me the script consultant, so that in situations like this tonight, I won't complain. But it was a good conversation, actually. He read the book very intelligently. The only difference of opinion we had was over the imaginative scope of Matilda imagining Dickensian in England. And one of the things about a screenplay is it's not really a literary document. It's kind of like a manual. And there's nothing seductive or enchanting about a screenplay. So it's very difficult for somebody who's not familiar with that kind of language or the way that a film is locked down into a screenplay to see what the director sees. But he was able to see, obviously. He was very familiar with this form. But there was just these little areas that I couldn't see what he could see as a director. But it was all perfectly civilized, you know.
Hmm. Let's open it up to the audience now, and we'll see how enthusiastic you are about asking questions. So please raise a hand if you've got something to you. You in the orange corduroy jacket there. I'll just repeat the question there as much as I can. And the question's about the comparison between the central character Watt on screen and in the novel, and whether the character in the novel was perhaps less sympathetic or more traumatized or just perhaps, yeah.
No, I think Hugh Laurie's portrait of him is very, very close. I don't think, if you read the book, I don't think you'll see a difference of character whatsoever. Yeah.
So I've got a follow up question, and that is related to Hugh Laurie as well. Were you consulted over that casting? Was that something that was floated past you?
It was floated past me, but my opinion wasn't going to make or break it. And there were other contenders. Hugh, he seemed quite an obvious choice, actually, for all sorts of reasons. And although the first time I ever saw him was on the rushes when I was visiting the film location on Andrew's boat. And he seemed the least convincing of all the actors. It was a very strange thing, actually. But, of course, he turns in a brilliant performance. But I think I was just so pleasantly surprised by the persuasiveness of all the local people that when the white guy finally comes on screen, he seemed like an imposter. But it was dear old Hugh.
All right, let's see who we've got. You might have to yell as well. Okay, I can see a shadow of it. Okay, that's a great question. So the question is, when you're watching the film, are there scenes or shots that you feel get across what you were trying to get across as an author?
Well, it's a tricky one because there are things one wants to get across, but in a curious sort of way, in an ironic way, you don't want to spill them out. But in the film, I suppose there's that moment where Mr. Watts tells the kids to close their eyes and to recite their names to themselves softly, just to themselves, that so no one has ever spoken their name in quite the same way. So it's a way of finding their own voice that can't be taken away from them, their access to their imagination, the keys to their imagination. I have found that scene remarkably powerful, as other scenes, but in terms of a message, as you put it, that would be something I'm quite comfortable with conveying to as many young readers or young people as possible.
I saw a hand in the front row here. That's a really good question. You mentioned earlier on that Matilda's voice arrived really early for you, but how did you do that, get into the head of a 14-year-old girl?
Well, it's remarkably easy. In fact, I can get into any voice. I can get into any skin whatsoever, more easily than my own, actually. But you have to remember, when people talk about, you know, how did you get that character, it's not as if that character exists outside of the page. So the character on the page is a sum of everything that I happen to bring to that person, the voice, what they see, what they hear, how they speak, how they think. So it's actually not difficult. I'm not trying to portray somebody who's already out there.
And I guess that, you know, the moment you write something about a character, it makes it true about them, doesn't it?
I mean, well, it does, but I mean, writing is an act of persuasion, so it stands and falls on the quality of the voice and the detail that is brought to that character, how they behave, how they act, all this sort of thing. Yeah.
Also in the front row there.
Oh, I think she's real too. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Actually, I remember a couple of times in the UK when I was doing festivals and so what, I'd often be asked, I'd be signing books, and I can remember one instance where this young woman came up to me and she looked at me and she was very, very anxious. She said, "Did Matilda go back to Bougainville? Because in the book she doesn't." And she was talking about a real person, you know. I said, "Gee, I don't know. What do you think?" She said, "I think she does. Yeah, she must have."
All right. Yes, I can see a hand there.
No, it was very clever. It was a bit of reverse colonization of you know, of course, if somebody from that part of the world is to imagine Dickensian England, they're going to send a little bit of the tropical island back there. And so all those tropical colours was a nice little imaginative leap. I think Andrew was responsible for that, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
And in the second row. Right. So I'll try and repeat the question, which is that in the book, Matilda goes through a long period of depression as a result of what she's experienced, and some of that's perhaps missing from the film in terms of in order to process the narrative, etc. I mean, how do you feel about that?
I feel fine about it. I mean, it's a hard thing to portray, really. I mean, there are other aspects. I mean, she has a intellectual falling out with Dickens. That's not in the film either. You know, Dickens is not who she thought he was. And the discrepancy between the man he was and the reputation as an author, and you know, there's all that coming of age and coming into sort of adult truthhood and reality. Well, that's not there either, but it's not something that's missed, I don't think. I didn't miss it when I watched the film.
You told me while we were waiting outside that you've seen 7 different versions of this film now as it's progressed.
Perhaps you could see another one.
So you're not going to be signing off on the home video, the DVD, make sure that it's approved, author approved?
No, it's been interesting, actually, every step of the way. I was just saying to Dan, the very first time I saw the film, there was no sound, no ambient sound, and the next time I saw it, it improved it by about 25-30%. But right up until about 2 weeks before the premiere in Auckland, I mean, Andrew was editing and rejigging and putting things out, taking things out and putting things in. It was right to the wire.
And the film I mean, it's had a long sort of gestation period, including a sort of birth and then a withdrawal. There was a world premiere at Toronto of a version of the film, which was well received by audiences there, but then it sort of disappeared from view for a while. Are you aware of what was going on there?
I am. Well, it sort of wasn't really the world premiere. It was invited by the director of the Toronto Film Festival, who described it as the most sophisticated film he had seen that year, which was a nice thing to say. And there was a very strong audience response. But it was a very long film at that point. I think it might have been about 2 hours, 30 minutes. And so it was always going to have to be reshaped. But reshaped to what? To what cut? You know, that was the question. Yeah, you never want to get into film, by the way. If you have children who want to be filmmakers, just anything but, you know. I can't imagine it. I just cannot imagine spending my life in that way. Yeah.
So do you know, like, what in terms of that reshaping from 2.5 hours down to what we've just seen, which is just under 2 hours now, in your opinion, what did that shaping take?
Well, it's like a story. Something has to have form. It has to have a pleasing form. And there were a few bulges. It was a pacing issue. And then there was some discussion about exposition at the start of the film. To what extent does an audience have to know about this place, the political context and all this kind of thing. So those sorts of things largely. And I know there was some discussion about the violence, but I cannot see any changes that have been made there, actually. Perhaps a few seconds have been shaved off here and there. I'm not really aware of that, but it seems very much to be the same level of violence. Incidentally, on that violence, when Matilda's mother, Dolores, you remember that scene where she gets raped and so forth? Well, I was on the island in Pidia when that scene was shot, and I shared a banana boat a couple of hours later back to Aroa with her and the three Defence Force soldiers who had raped her. And one of them, when they were filming that scene, kept throwing up. And then hours later on the boat, he was inconsolable, couldn't speak. And Dolores on the beach, she said to me, she said, "Lloyd, everything else has been acting, but that was not acting." It was a very odd thing. There were so many moments like this where, you know, there I am 5 minutes away in the Hannah's factory writing this novel years ago, you know, creating this scene, to actually stepping into the scene and stepping out of it with the participants. Very odd, very odd.
And seeing the fallout.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I was sort of, to be, it'll sound terrible, but I was quite encouraged. if she felt that way and the soldier was in that state and all the rest of it. Mind you, one of the other soldiers chatted away quite happily, so, yeah.
Let's see if we've got, I can see one hand on the far side there. All right, which I wouldn't have been able to see, so thank you.
Well, you have. Did you see the earlier version?
No.
Okay. Yeah. Well, as I said, I really, quite honestly, can't tell the difference between what you saw tonight and the earlier versions. And the only thing I can think of is perhaps it went, the same violence went on a bit longer. Maybe the scene with the pigs, when they're dragging the bodies away to be chopped up, there may have been a couple of seconds there that were more graphic, perhaps. You might have seen a machete coming down on a body.
And any filmmaker in the audience will tell you that it doesn't take more than a second to, you know, to completely change or to transform the mood and vibe of a scene. So perhaps wouldn't have needed many changes at all. I think it's a pretty sensitively handled sequence, you know.
Still very visceral, I think. I don't think it leaves any doubt as to what is happening.
No, and it does ask audiences to fill in some gaps of their own, which I think audiences, you know, good audiences will respond positively to and accept that challenge.
Well,
there's we've had one comment about imagination being, you know, a crucial part of the film and the themes of the film, and Graham, another comment about, you know, perhaps shaving a couple of seconds off might have actually been the difference between an R and an M, which, you know, it's a couple of million bucks at the box office, isn't it? That change, and so let's see if we've got some more hands. I can see. Oh, okay, that's a good question. So, to the book or to the film or to both? To the film. So reactions from Bougainvillians or Papua New Guineans to the film. Have they had an opportunity to see it yet?
They haven't seen the film. I heard that it's opening in Port Moresby in November, which is curious. I know Andrew's committed to getting a screening to Bougainville, which will be very, very difficult. But they're very, very interested. I was over there a couple of months ago for the opening of a library we've been involved with, and every second question I was asked, when can we see the film? Because half of them are in it, of course, you know. Yeah.
And how is the library project going?
Oh, that's good. It's all done and dusted. It's a beautiful building. It's half stocked with books. We need to get more books there. There's a VSA volunteer librarian who's training a local librarian. There's a local person, Alan Guioni. He's employed as the manager. He's sort of very culturally entrepreneurial. Everything's good. Yeah.
And people can still make contributions to that project?
They can if they.
How might they do that?
Oh gosh, Wellingtonians have been so generous in this project. I hate to even pass around the hat, but you can if you want. So, the BougainvilleLibrary.org. Yeah, you'll get all the information there.
All right. Any more hands? I saw. Oh look, they're thick and fast at the moment. So how about on the far side there? Right. So the question is about Great Expectations, and did that have a specific sort of significance for you?
It did. It was the first adult book I read as a child. I still remember. In those days, there were door to door salesmen who sold books, and I remember my mother. I was home sick from school, and she came in and threw a couple of Charles Dickens that just about killed me. But the Great Expectations was one of them, And you can read it on a certain sort of level, on a boyish kind of level. It's very, very easy to identify with Pip, and right from that moment that he encounters Magwitch. So it's an adventure story on one level. But then when I read it in my early 20s, I read it in an entirely different way, as a more aware of my place in the Pacific, as an immigrant and all that kind of thing. More aware of the orphan and the immigrant having quite a bit in common. And so when it came to choosing a book for Mr. Watts to read to those children, that was the one I thought of, because for another reason, it would be the ultimate challenge for them to have to imagine a place, another place, out of time and place, I should say, Dickensian London. What could be more challenging, and yet to make sense of it out of using what lay around them. So yes, it was the obvious one for me.
We've got time for a couple more questions, and I saw that there were enough hands to fill that quota, so perhaps we'll start with you in the front row. Okay, so the question is about one, your insistence that they actually go to Bougainville to make the film, and also on including local people and incorporating local people into the shooting.
Well, it's a part of the world that never makes the big screen. There's that, and secondly, I didn't want sort of African Americans to be playing this role. There would be something unconvincing about all of that. And a third, it would just seem sort of slightly insulting, actually. I didn't know what I was asking, of course. What I was asking was tremendously difficult, and what they went through was hell, you know.
I was going to say that it's possibly the most difficult shoot of any New Zealand film in history.
Yeah, they told me this frequently, yeah. But, there were no comforts, very, very difficult, and a remarkable crew of people, actually. Someone told me that at some point Hugh Laurie said to somebody, he said, "Why don't you New Zealanders ever bitch or complain? You know, no one's throwing a hissy fit or anything like that." Now, I have a funny feeling, or one that you like to think it's that good New Zealand quality you all pitch in together, but I think perhaps they chose a crew that was able to be quite resilient and adaptable.
And perhaps some hissy fits were thrown or out of earshot of Mr. Laurie.
Possibly, yeah.
There was another question in the middle of the second row there. Wow, that's a really good question, and that's about, I guess, the balance between being a writer of fiction and a desire to be journalistically accurate in what you write.
That's a really good question. I think really good things, imaginative things, when you happen when you're operating on the edge of not knowing. And for me, voice is such has primacy, actually. If I can find the voice in which to tell a story, that voice can take me anywhere. Now, the other part of it, of course, is the journalistic detail. That also is important. And I'm the kind of writer who doesn't really conjure up something out of nothing. I respond to the world. So something out there is the spark. It's the grain of sand in the oyster, if you like. It's an interesting kind of relationship between the two things, just the pure imagination and that thing that you're bringing the imagination to bear upon. The two things are operating together, but at different times, one has perhaps primacy over the others. But I think that journalistic detail is terribly important. I talked about the persuasiveness of language. Persuasiveness of story depends to some extent on getting detail right. Quite aside from the enchantment of voice or the persuasiveness of voice, what you talk about, what you describe, those details, if they're not right, they're going to break the act of faith between the reader and the language on the page.
All right. We've got time for one more before I'll attempt to wrap this up. So if there's anybody who's got something desperately to get off their chest, I can see a hand waving. Yes. Where did the actress who played Matilda come from, and how was she discovered?
Well, it was I hope you agree, a very good discovery. That was the work of Robin Scholes. They went looking, they cast in that very, very far and wide, right throughout Melanesia and in Australia. And they came up with a short list, and then I think they did some workshopping with five of them, and Exania was chosen, I think. The thing about her, she seems to have she's very intelligent, but she's expressively intelligent too. I think in the film you can see her grasping things. And she just she manages to make that journey between 14 and 17 pretty effortlessly too. Mm.
Well, I've got one more.
14 and 22, I should say.
Yes, yeah. Indeed.
Yeah. She's 17 now. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Mm. Yes, that is quite an achievement. While we wrap up, I noticed that on the poster outside it has the tagline from Anne, the strangely non-specific tagline, from Anne award-winning novel by Lloyd Jones, not necessarily the award-winning novel by Lloyd Jones. That presumes that there there are many more out there, if not.
Let me know.
So what are you working on at the moment, and what's the next thing that we'll published?
I've just published a memoir, a history of silence, and there's a couple other projects. Right now I'm editing an issue of Griffith Review, which is an Australian arts journal, which is devoting the next issue to New Zealand and New Zealand writing. So that's quite exciting. Yeah. Hopefully there'll be something good. Hopefully.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing the results of that. Mm-hmm. And of course, your new book is in bookshops now.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And, of course, Mr. Pip is still being reprinted?
Yes.
How many languages has it been translated in? It always fascinates me how wide these things go.
Well, it's... in the publishing world, you speak of territories, 42 territories, and I suppose of those there would be 6 English-speaking ones, so the rest are foreign language, yeah. I'm constantly getting new Korean ones or China. I was in Taipei recently and I was answering questions about Mr. Pip, and there was the Chinese version.
Fantastic. Lloyd Jones, thanks very much for your time, for coming out to be with us here at the Lighthouse Cinema for the special Q&A. Please, ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for Lloyd Jones.
Thank you.